The Guardian. Trust is a tricky concept. When we trust someone or something, it means we hold a belief in their reliability. You and I rely every day on services provided by huge and powerful institutions, but do we trust them? And if not, then who? And how has that changed now that we live so much of our lives online?
Destroying trust, undermining trust, takes almost nothing. A small episode can immediately seed doubts, mistrust, and lead to a different relationship.
I'm Jordan Erica Weber, and in this series, we're looking at internet-enabled dystopia and how even technology designed to do good can end up causing harm.
Almost 3.5 billion people already use the internet, and some 500 new users are added every minute. But even as we flock to this technology and all that it gives us access to, there are growing concerns about how our online lives can be open to scrutiny and even attack.
In this show, we consider the changing face of trust, looking at how and why we are losing our trust in institutions and who we can trust instead.
So I think we are at the start of one of the biggest trust shifts in the history of humankind.
Rachel Botsman is an expert in trust.
A lot of pain that we're seeing in the world can be understood if we think of trust shifting from institutions to individuals.
For many, many reasons, a lot of us are losing trust in institutions.
You know what? Right now, breaking news here, stocks all around the world are tanking.
We're losing trust in corporations that harvest our data so they can use it to make money, and in banks whose failures cause financial crises.
How jittery the nerves must be in Wall Street for that open.
We're certainly losing trust in politicians, as seems clear in the recent election of a man who regularly said that he wasn't one.
I am with you. I will fight for you, and I will win for you.
But that doesn't mean there's less trust in the world. According to Botsman, we're just diverting it elsewhere.
So there is this narrative out there that trust is in a state of crisis, and I think what it's referring to is sort of our erosion of faith in traditional institutions. But I think it's more helpful to think of trust a bit like energy, that it can't actually be destroyed in society, that it's changing form. So for a long period in history, trust flowed through institutions, and we invented sort of institutional mechanisms of trust so that we didn't have to trust one another directly. So everything from corporate brands that very much controlled a message of what we should think of products and services, trusted intermediaries from real estate agents to lawyers to auditors and regulators, and even sort of risk mechanisms like insurance. And so trust became very institutionalized. And now what's happening is that we're seeing sort of this inversion of trust, this trust that used to flow upwards, whether that was to an expert or a regulator or to a leader or a CEO, is now through technology, through networks and platforms and systems, it's flowing sideways. And that could be to so-called friends, it could be to complete strangers on the internet, to neighbours or colleagues. And we're seeing this playing out in all different areas of our lives.
Instinctively, you might not feel like you put a lot of trust in other individuals, especially not strangers. But the internet has enabled what has become known as a sharing economy. The exact definition of which is debated, but which generally means a system in which regular people can share resources, like spare seats in their car or spare rooms in their home. Thanks to services like BlaBlaCar and Airbnb, we regularly behave in ways that would have seemed unthinkably risky to our parents or grandparents. We get into cars with strangers. We let strangers sleep in our houses. We even meet strangers for sex.
It is remarkable, really, how technology is enabling trust amongst strangers. And, you know, Airbnb or online dating, there's some examples, Meetup, where we're using digital tools to have face-to-face interactions. We're actually using the internet to get off the internet and meet up in the real world. And the thing that is remarkable about these is that, you know, even 10 years ago, they would have been perceived as risky, stupid, dangerous. You know, I think BlaBlaCar is an amazing example where people are sharing long distance journey together, so journeys that on average are over 300 kilometers, and it's not so long ago that that would have been called hitchhiking. And so what's really interesting is how technology can provide the tools to give information about people, that there is some degree of comfort, that when we meet them they don't feel like a stranger. And it is remarkable how well these ideas work. Yes, they do break down, but you know, this sense of connection that we can have with a complete stranger on the other side of the world, to the extent that we're willing to open up our homes and let them stay there, is really a very powerful result of distributed trust through technology.
With distributed trust, we don't have to put our trust in powerful institutions that may have let us down. Instead, we send the trust sideways to other people like us. Rachel Botsman thinks we'll see even more examples of distributed trust in future, as new technology provides new ways to put our trust in strangers.
My interest in this area really started from my work on sort of the collaborative, or what people call the sharing economy. And that is based on this idea that we all have assets, whether they are assets that we individually own or assets at a city level, that are underutilized, where they're not used to their full capacity. So the obvious example people will think of is spare rooms in homes, but it can also be empty seats in cars. It could be the extra bandwidth you don't use on your telco plan. It could be the energy you create from your solar panels. What's happening is that technology is enabling us to unlock the value of that capacity, that island capacity, and to share that value through these networks and systems. What's interesting is sort of the first wave of this, we really saw the rise of the platform, you know, whether that's someone like Etsy, where you can now, you know, make money from your craft and your passions, and it connects you with sellers. But what's interesting is the next wave, where we're starting to see the blockchain decentralize this even further. So a good example of that would be something like TransEnergy Grid, and it's in early stages, but it's just getting started, where neighbors can take the excess capacity they create from their solar panels and sell it on to other neighbors through the blockchain. So it becomes really interesting in terms of, if you can facilitate trust through technology, does it actually change the way value literally flows through the pipes of society and the economy?
The blockchain is a shared trustworthy infrastructure that lots of different actors can use, and be certain that no minority set of actors can cheat the system, basically. The third is crypto economics, which marries the first two. So it enables...
The most important thing about the blockchain is to separate the blockchain or blockchain technology from Bitcoin. And so I think of the blockchain as the backbone, if you like, or the architecture that was designed underneath this cryptocurrency. It's basically a digital public ledger. Rather than two parties having a ledger that tracks the exchange of assets, you now have this shared public ledger where if I transferred something of value to someone else, and that doesn't have to be money, it would be recorded and timestamped on the blockchain.
So a blockchain is basically a chain of connected blocks, linked using cryptography, where each block is a record that can only be altered if other blocks are altered too, making it a particularly secure way to record data without the need for a central authority. The first blockchain was implemented to record Bitcoin transactions and was conceptualized by the same anonymous person or group, known as Satoshi Nakamoto, that invented the cryptocurrency. But that's not its only use.
So if we think trust has gone local, institutional, distributed, what is next? You know, the sun is really setting on platforms in terms of not taking accountability of responsibility for what happens. So I think these platforms, in a funny way, will become the new institutions and will be demanding levels of accountability, and we'll be pointing at, we already are, in the same way, for example, that we point to the banks. The responsibility of the platform and the company behind that, and the new power dynamic between the platform and its users, I think will take a very different form. And I think, what does the institution look like at the centre of a platform or in a distributed model becomes really interesting. You know, the blockchain, will it become more mainstream? I think one of the near-in applications of the blockchain is going to be around smart contracts. You know, as the cost of trust plummets, if you like, where you don't need to pay a lawyer or you don't need to pay a real estate agent to exchange an asset, I think that's the near-in way people would start to feel the blockchain and start to go, oh yeah, I see how the internet transformed communication, and this new ledger technology is starting to transform the way I can transfer value and trust other people without the need for intermediaries and process.
Time for a quick break, I think. When we come back, we'll look at how we come to put our trust in other people.
So trust really is something that qualifies the interactions between you and me when it comes to a particular relation.
If every citizen has a score that is influenced by different kinds of things that they do, it will hold people more accountable.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. From Airbnb to blockchains, we're putting our trust in individuals rather than in institutions. In many cases, those individuals are total strangers. So how do we come to trust them?
Trust is something that we, in everyday life, build through time.
We spoke to Luciano Floridi, Professor of Philosophy and Ethics of Information at the University of Oxford.
And online, we build by acquiring increasing amount of information on the other agent, for example, that we trust. The building requires some effort, either a lot of time, interactions, knowledge of the other person, for example, or the acquisition of a lot of information, maybe comparing websites, peer-reviewed, etc. So it's a bit like running uphill. Destroying trust, undermining trust, takes almost nothing. A small episode can immediately seed doubts, mistrust, and lead to a different relationship. When it comes to online, this can be even more fragile, precisely because we don't have interactions with the other party apart from that specific negotiation or service, and we don't meet necessarily in real life. We only know the other person by what we see on a website, for example. In this sense, trust can easily be undermined with just a few mistakes, and the curation of trust becomes a long-term work in progress.
Apple almost kicked Uber out of the App Store a few years ago for being reckless with user privacy by keeping track of and identifying iPhone users even after the app had been deleted from the phone.
When we participate in the sharing economy through services like Airbnb and Uber, we often have to build trust over time by proving our reliability in a quantifiable way through ratings and reviews.
Where Cook said to him calmly, "So I've heard you've been breaking some of our rules."
In some ways, this seems more difficult than getting someone to trust you in the offline world, where a winning smile can get you a long way. But in other ways, it's easier. With these specific services, you only have to convince people to trust you for one thing.
We used to say that trust was a matter of touch, not trust without touch. That was the phrase. The truth is that we trust online, digitally, without ever having met the other party on an ordinary basis. This happens because trust really is what we would call a second-order relation. In other words, a relation that qualifies other relations. This may be much clearer with an analogy. Imagine running and describing the running as quickly. Well, quickly qualifies the running. Likewise, trust qualifies, for example, the relation I may have with someone when someone is selling me something. The same person may not be trusted when doing some spelling, for example. So I could trust you in the way you drive, but not you in the way you cook. So trust really is something that qualifies the interactions between you and me when it comes to a particular relation. It is the ability of establishing that second order trust relation that has made a whole difference in our online interactions.
So maybe you wouldn't trust me to drive you to the airport, which is wise because I've never driven a car in my life, but you would trust me to bake you a cake because you've seen my extensive portfolio of baked goods and read the wonderful reviews I've had from the people I've made them for. You could have that belief in my reliability as a baker, even if you've never actually met me.
The fact that we can trust people on the other side of the world without having met anyone, in a way, it's reassuring. It's almost like building a wider sense of humanity. It comes with a specific qualification. The reason why I'm trusting someone on the other side of the world is because I've chosen that particular relationship in terms of which I'm exercising my trust. It's more difficult when it comes to everyday life, when I have to trust people, say in a small village in the middle of nowhere, because I need something, and I'm kind of forced to trust or rely upon other people without having any choice about whom to trust but the person next to me. So in a way, we are expanding our human relations and the network of trustworthy interactions that we can enjoy by being a little bit more careful in terms of the choices we make. In a small village, it's very hard not to trust your neighbor, but you only have that neighbor. In the larger, big village that is this world of ours, you have many more choices about whom to trust and therefore a bit more of a rational approach to the sort of trustworthy relationships that you can establish.
So one of the things that deeply concerns me is how fast we are outsourcing our trust to algorithms.
Because this distributed trust is taking place online, it's mitigated through technology.
What's interesting is sort of,
we may feel like we're making informed decisions about which strangers we can trust, but we're being helped along by computer algorithms designed to make the process more efficient.
Technology, it wants to make things seamless. It wants to make things, you know, on demand and accelerated. This efficiency is like the enemy of the process of trust, because trust actually requires a little bit of friction. It requires us to slow down and to think, is this personal thing or piece of content worthy of our trust? The area that, of course, has so much attention right now is in the news space. You know, I think fake news has taken the headline, but there's two almost opposite problems going on. One, you've got, you know, as Elie Parise called it, you know, the filter bubbles or the echo chambers, where the right kind of information is not getting in, because what technology does is it sorts us into these online neighborhoods where we find people with similar interests and similar voices. So we're not always hearing and seeing what we need to hear. We're finding information that really amplifies our anger or confirms our views. And then on the flip side of that, you've got the problem of misinformation and fake content and bots and algorithms really deciding what we see, and that these bots can be completely anonymous and be manipulated, as we've seen with the US presidential election. But that issue is really a symptom of a much deeper problem, which is this idea of outsourcing our trust to algorithms. And the reason why I think this is so significant is that I think of our relationship to technology to date has really, our trust in it, I should say, has been on it doing something for us. And that means that it has to be reliable and dependable and predictable when it's doing something. But now technology is deciding something with the rise of AI and automation and bots. And so this transition from doing something to deciding something has massive implications, because now you have to trust the intentions of the technology.
There are two categories of news. Let me take on the first one that has to do with us, CNN. At the beginning of the press conference, Sean Spicer, who's going to be the White House press secretary, suggested that both BuzzFeed and CNN published this dossier full of uncorroborated rumors. That's not true.
And relying on algorithms to tell us who to trust means we're also putting our trust in the algorithms themselves. But can we actually trust a non-human decision maker?
The way we assess trust is based on whether someone or something is trustworthy. And there is a real science behind this that we really see. It comes down to four traits. Competence: is it capable of doing what it says it can do? Reliability, which is really how dependable and responsive it is. And I think on those two traits, we do assess, we actually make the same assessment whether it is an artificially intelligent machine or whether it is a real human being. Where it differs is on the why side of the equation, so why someone is doing something. And that really comes down to benevolence, how much does this person care, and their integrity, which is not whether they're a good person, but much more about their intentions and whether their intentions are aligned with yours or mine. And that why side of the equation is really hard to even get right when you're assessing a human being. Like, you rely on all kinds of different signals and context and information from all these different sources. So when that bot or that AI algorithm is invisible, understanding how it cares and what its intentions really are, they're kept hidden. So that is really tricky when it comes to assessing whether it's trustworthy or whether it's not. And the other thing is that the intentions can be confusing, right? So, you know, I think of my daughter's relationship with Alexa. Now, she would never use the word trustworthy, but she would say probably it's good or it does what I ask it to do. But there's no way she would understand that Amazon was the corporate master behind this helpful female assistant. So it does differ on the why side of the equation of trust.
When we're talking about needing to understand the intentions of an algorithm, we're talking about the intentions of the human beings behind it.
World of ours, you have...
Algorithms cannot bear responsibility, but the humans who create and use them can.
There's a form of responsibility that we provide with trust that, of course, a mechanism cannot bear. A mechanism is not responsible for things that may go wrong. It might be accountable. In other words, it may be the causal effect that is providing some justification for things not being as they should have been. But responsibility implies understanding what's going on and intentionality. I mean to do something, or I did not mean to do something else. Insofar as trust is a matter of responsibility and intentionality, then the truth is that we really trust only other agents like us, agents that are able of intentional states. They mean to do what they are doing, and they understand what they are doing. When we are trusting an algorithm, what we really are doing largely is to trust the people behind the algorithm. I trust that the people at the bank are using the right algorithm to decide about my mortgage. I trust that the people behind the cinema implementing the right algorithm to buy the tickets for that particular show. So I would be a little bit reluctant to talk of full trust when it comes to technologies in themselves without including in the loop also the humans behind.
Of course, part of the problem with trusting algorithms is that we often don't understand their inner workings. They provide us with consistent results, but we don't know how they're doing it.
There are already contexts in which we have technologies that are rather opaque in doing what they're doing. We may speak of a black box. These mechanisms are based on different kind of artificial intelligence, so-called neural networks and deep learning. They're not mysterious, they're just very complex. It's a bit like trying to understand why there's so much traffic on Monday morning at 8:30 in London by trying to explain why every car is there at that time, precisely for what reasons. Kind of impossible, and yet I know exactly that there's so much traffic because it's peak time. rush hour. It does mean that when I trust a black box, well, one wonder exactly what am I trusting? I'm trusting that black box, that algorithm that has become very powerful and rather opaque in its own operations, is fair and can be transformed into something else if the outcome is unwelcome. So at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter so much whether I can tell what every single node in that network did, when, how, and according to what threshold, etc., as long as I know that the whole system is still something that I can control and change. Which leads us to a different kind of trust. Trust in the people on the loop, not in the loop, but on the loop, that are able to control and change, modify, stop, redress the operations of that particular mechanism.
I think they should always look out for organisations that are transparent about how they use their data. Organisations that provide control, as we do, so people can decide what they want to share and who they want to share it with.
When it comes to delegating mechanisms, technologies, trust can be enhanced, can actually be established to begin with, only if we know that someone somewhere is able to control or supervise or rectify what's going on.
Well, I think you need to provide a lot of information on your site itself, as we do. Not kind of shove it in people's faces. I'm not sure that, for instance, the stuff around cookies and the privacy directive has worked particularly well.
It would be a little bit strange if I were to trust, say, my dishwasher blindly, no matter what, without having, for example, the possibility of turning it off if something goes deeply wrong. Now, the same happens with any other mechanism, any other technology. It would be very risky if we were to delegate any process entirely 100% to an automatic system without the remotest possible way of controlling or rectifying its operations. My impression is that we will trust increasingly the technologies we are building, insofar as we can also show that there is a lack of transparency but a very high degree of control of those technologies.
I kept trying to search for examples of distributed forms of trust where there was no centre and there was no leader, and I couldn't find them. I think it's human nature. It doesn't necessarily have to be a centre, but there has to be a point or a person where there is some form of accountability. You know, and we particularly see this when things go wrong. So we like the idea of empowerment and we like the idea of these democratized systems until we need someone to fix the problem or there's someone to blame. And even examples that I think are remarkable, and so the International Consortium of Journalists that work together on things like the Panama Papers, where these are journalists working for competing media organizations, and they're using technologies to share information and solve really big global fraud cases, there's still a leader there, this incredible guy called Gerard Ryle. There's still someone they turn to set the rules. My opinion is that trust cannot be completely decentralized and distributed. It still needs some kind of center, which is why I find some of the promises of the blockchain a little overhyped, that it's a completely trustless system.
Good morning. That lawyer is just the latest example of China cracking down on anyone who strays from the party line. And now China's government is testing a new social credit score system, which would rank its citizens based on their online behavior.
Even when we're trusting in algorithms to make decisions for us about which individuals we can trust, we're also trusting in the central authority behind them.
China are proposing that by 2020, every citizen in China will have what they call a social citizen score, or you could think of it as a trust score. What's interesting is that when you read the policy documents, the justification is economic, right? So many people in China don't have a traditional credit history. There's really high rates of fraud and counterfeit goods. And so what the Chinese government are saying is that if every citizen has a score that is influenced by different kinds of things that they do, it will hold people more accountable. But what's worrying is the level of surveillance. It's about your purchasing habits, and there's a distinction between the types of goods that you buy. There's obvious things like whether you pay your bills on time and also what you say, right? So if you say something that happens to be negative about the government, your score would go down.
Now, that social credit score system would not be rolled out for a few more years, but it apparently is already having a chilling effect.
On a surface level, you might think it's reasonable to give citizens a score that represents how well they've behaved. Again, it's about finding a way to mark individuals as trustworthy.
Seth, very interesting story. Thank you so much. Can you imagine in this country if you lost your job because of something you said on Twitter about the government?
A common response when questioning practices like this in countries other than our own is to assume that it would never happen here.
The tendency is to write that and to point the finger at China and go, well, that's never going to happen in the West. And what frightened me is how close we are in the West. And when you interview people in China, they say, look, you have this culture of constant surveillance. The data companies, they know where you are at all times. The video cameras in the streets are observing you. Like, you know, these cameras are in your homes now. It's just that you're not actually aware, Westerners, in terms of what's happening to this data. So at least this is a transparent system. And so I don't think it will ever look like the Chinese system in terms of citizens letting the government give them a trust score, but we are not that far off in terms of the surveillance and the culture of constant tracking. It's just the way that manifests is going to look very different from the way it looks in China.
Perhaps China shines a light on our own issues with transparency, a topic we'll explore further in the final episode of this series. But in the next episode, we're going to take a look at how a lack of transparency might be causing serious problems in democracies closer to home.
To all Americans tonight, in all of our cities and in all of our towns, I make this promise. We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night. I love you.
Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.